Well, as you see, we're starting a series in Genesis, and the plan, if the Lord is willing, is that we will get through the first 11 chapters of Genesis between now and up until the Christmas season, the time of Advent. And so that's our plan. We will have next week a sermon that Zach was hoping to preach with our Psalms series, and that is Psalm 136. So he's put a lot of work into that. So you can pray for him this week as he prepares. And then we'll also hear from Gordon Eschker in October about the new creation from the book of Revelation, related very much with these things. This book of Genesis often brings up questions, and there are some of the most foundational things. When we look at this first creation account this week, what we see is sort of a from earth, like standing on the land perspective, looking out at what God has made, looking up to the heavens, that is what is above us in the sky, and of the earth, of the things that are here. It is from this perspective. In a few weeks, we will change, and in chapter 2, verse 4, there's a switch where we get to see some of the specifics of how God did this. And the perspective comes closer to humanity and how he made man and how he made woman and the details of this. So this week, as we look at this perspective from the earth, looking up at what God has made, what we see is this. The big concept that we get is this, that God, in all of his greatness and in all of his goodness and power, is the creator. And we'll look at it under three headings today. First, we'll look at God, the creator, and then we will look at man, who is made in his image, and then we will look at this unique seventh day, which is holy, the Sabbath. So God, man, Sabbath. The big picture here, then, is for us to get a concept of who God is as the creator. This is what he is revealing to us. Now, whenever we get to the book of Genesis, if you've been around the Christian culture in our generation and in recent generations, some of the first questions will come up. Things like, how did things come about? How did God make everything? And so you have to have sort of a view on this. The biblical view on the origin of all things is God. That God is without beginning, but the world, the creation that we have, has a beginning. There was a time before anything existed when God alone existed, and he has always existed, but then God made everything. But a view that is contrary to this is the most common in our day, which would be a view called materialism or naturalism. Now, in the history of the world, if you look up something, if you do a quick internet search and look up creation myths, okay, there are these things called creation myths, and you'll find dozens of them at least. These are accounts from different tribes, different cultures through the history of the world that seek to give a reason, give an explanation for how did we get here? How did we come about? How are there people? How is there a world? And so you'll find very interesting and unique stories about this. Some of them are similar to others, which is interesting. The great myth for how creation has come about, which is alive and well today, is what we can call materialism. And so you see this with scientists like the former astrophysicist Stephen Hawking. Such a brilliant mind. And I want to speak respectfully. One of the things that he said was this. He spoke about the universe, and he said, the universe is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. And my question is, you weren't ever before your life. You don't know what is yet coming. How can you possibly know such a thing? But this represents the view that we call materialism or naturalism, that what is in nature is all that is. And we are simply a part of that, sort of random, sort of a part of this development of the unfolding of the world. And so scientists, good scientists, geologists, physicists, biologists, they look at the world as it is, and they can observe certain things, and they should, and that's what we ought to do. We should all do that. And just to do it honestly, will look at things and they'll see, for example, I had a physics teacher and he was explaining matter and how the universe is sort of blooming. It's sort of expanding and growing. And the students in my class, we were asking this in college, we're like, but where does all the material come from? Where does all the matter come from? And this guy was brilliant. This guy, he did his doctoral dissertation in pencil on one sheet of paper and then defended it successfully. And he said, well, it's all there. And then he did it. And he worked on the neutron accelerator. He said, listen, and he was not a Christian. He said, listen, the problem isn't the matter. The problem is the energy. And we were like, okay, great. But we took it from what he understood, that things are expanding. And he's saying, look, there's this blooming, this growing of the universe. And so it points back to an origin, that it came from something somewhere at a certain point in time. You just extrapolate backwards from what is happening now to say this began somewhere at some time. This idea of materialism, then, it represents different theories of evolution, different ideas that have been brought about, which exclude God. You see, to be a materialist is to say, like Stephen Hawking, the things that are physical that we can observe are all that are, all that ever were or will be. And so it necessarily says the Creator is not a part of that. Now, this is obviously a problem because God's Word comes in and says it came from something. All that is wasn't always here. There is a Creator who is the uncreated one. From Him, all things have come. And the Bible comes, and it doesn't debate. The Bible doesn't come in and say, oh, well, let's talk about the how of all of these things in these details. It simply declares. And the big point is that there is a God who is the Creator. And it's a very basic concept. From this, we have what I would call a worldview of scientism. Okay? Have you heard this term, scientism? It was one of C.S. Lewis's favorite terms, and he wrote about it in several of his books. One of his favorite, one of my favorite books where he explained this in detail and how the concept of scientism comes out is in the third of his space trilogies called That Hideous Strength. It's a really good book. Now, scientism is what? It is different than science itself. Scientism is where you take the concept that modern science itself defines all reality. That science, as we understand it, defines all reality. Now, to be a Christian is different than this worldview of scientism because we are defining reality with what God has revealed. Does that mean we are anti-science? No. And so it bothers me so much when you walk around and you see on people's signs that say science is real. And Christian, as a Christian, I feel like, yeah, I 100% agree with that. We are 100% in line with science. But that's different than scientism. Because the concept of scientism elevates this idea of modern science that if you have a group of professionals, they are the authorities on all things. And there is no realm that is outside of their authority. What science ought to be is the observation, the experimentation, the proving of theories to become, truths and axioms, that science is something that is observable, and we should do that. We should look at the world as it is. We should observe the way things are, and we should say, this we can observe, and this works in this way, therefore we have learned this. Scientism is different. Because the elevation of those that are considered the experts in all of these fields are considered the experts on more than just their field. They are considered the experts on things of morality. And so instead of just someone talking about geology or of climate or of the physical world, physics, biology, chemistry, you'll hear people that will make moral declarations for the world in which we live. That is scientism. Are we tracking together? Are you following with me on this? Now, here's the challenge. Very often Christians will reject plain science, which we ought not to do. And very often, those that are materialists, that sort of are persuaded by scientism, will reject biblical revelation. Now, here's the old illustration. You're familiar with Galileo. Galileo invented the telescope. And when Galileo invented the telescope, there was an understanding of the way the universe worked. And at that time, Newton had observed and created theories about all kinds of things. One of his theories was a bit off. Now, his laws of physical world and of motion, of mass and matter, they were wonderful. And those are still some of the very basics for our understanding of physics. But one of his ideas was that the world is this spherical thing about which the whole universe rotates, and that we on Earth are in the center. Now, honest mistake, because he was watching the moon, he was seeing the stars, and he was seeing the sun that seemed to be in motion around our planet. Well, he didn't understand the concept that the Earth was rotating, and those things had to be understood. Galileo comes along with his telescope, and what he does is he points it, and he points it at Jupiter. And by pointing it at Jupiter and looking at his telescope, he can see there are things that are floating around in space around this planet. There are four moons that are around this. And as he looked at it over time, he saw these are rotating around that planet. Now, Galileo went with this information. He said, I discovered something. The Earth isn't the center of the universe. We are actually, it seems to be rotating ourselves and going around the sun. And all of these things are in a dynamic that are different than the way we understood it before. The problem was this. The understanding of that time was fixed in people's minds. It was among the scientists. It was among the believers in the church. And these were in sync with one another. They were locked together. So Galileo went with this information and they said, that goes against science. And that goes against the Bible. And so both of these communities, which were very close together, were rejecting him. They brought him before Rome for an inquisition. They locked him up in his house. They said, we will not look in your telescope. And he said, but just look. He said, just look and you'll see for yourselves. You can decide for yourself. Just look. They wouldn't do it. He recanted what he knew was true, basically to save his neck. And it took time for people to then just look and observe what was clearly true. He was trying to say with the Christian community, with the science community, hey, look, this is the way things are. I can see it. And if you just look at this plain thing that's happening, you'll see it too. Well, the problem and the illustration there is this. We have, as Christians, we have the ability to not consider things that are in science. And we're sometimes accused of having our head in the sand like an ostrich that would bury our heads and not pay attention. I want to say this. Those that have a materialistic and naturalistic view of all reality are doing the exact same thing. And what we're saying is, there's another telescope. Will you look at it? God has made himself known. He has demonstrated it with everything he has made. And will you look at our telescope? It's here in the words of Scripture. It is historically proven out. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone's interpretation of the Scriptures has always been right. Clearly, it's not. But what the Bible tells us, though, is that God has made himself known. And the question is, are you willing to consider this? Now, this is a very foundational thing. So as we look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, we see, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What the Bible says in Romans is this, that everybody has a basic understanding of this. It says this in Romans, that God has revealed himself from heaven. He has made himself known, that people have some basic concept until we increasingly push that out. He says that what can be known about God is plain to all people because God has shown it to us. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So people, all people around the world are without excuse. Because this is what happens. God has made himself known, and we can look at a field of sunflowers, and we can look at sunrises, and we can look at babies that are born, and we can look at the things in God's creation. We can go to the Badlands or the deserts or the mountains or the ocean, and we can have this sense of awe, because in all that God has made in all creation, he is revealing himself. See, God made everything to reveal his glory. So when you see a powerful storm, you're getting a little glimpse of who God is through what he has made. When you see the beauty of a person or a sunset, then what you're getting is a little glimpse of who God is in all of his beauty and all of his goodness. When you have in this creation a sense of satisfaction with something that you eat, with rest for your body, with when you get to do something in this creation, what you're getting is a little glimpse of how God has made you in this world to reveal his glory. My question for someone that doesn't believe this is this: will you consider and will you look through this telescope? Well, what God does in this first chapter of Genesis is a simple declaration. God doesn't enter into a debate. God is just revealing these things, what he has done. He is ultimately, over this, revealing himself. And the structure that we get with the first 6 days, and then the seventh is different, with the first 6 days is a very clear and repeated pattern. The first 3 days, God creates the environment. And then in days 4, 5, and 6, he creates things to fill and to rule all of these. One of the things that I think is really neat is he creates things with kinds, and he creates seeds so that there are sort of secondary causes within God's creation, things that unfold, things that are to be discovered, things that are to be realized within creation. So God is making all of these, like he did with the beginning when things were formless and void, and then God brought order and he brought goodness, and things were realized in their perfections. So has God with creation. Francis Schaeffer wrote a book, The God Who Is There. And in the later chapters of that book, Schaeffer explains that we are unfolding things that God has put into this creation. And we always are. So that you go to the Amazon forest, and I was talking about this with another man with a background in science as well. You go there, and then people have discovered from the trees the pills that we take for Tylenol. You know, we can find painkillers. We can find things that heal in God's creation that are all here. Things are being discovered with magnetism. Things are being realized with heat transfer. You go into the deserts in the southwest of the United States, and it just looks dry and barren. Like, what is here? There's caves. It looks kind of neat when the sun's setting, but really, what's here? Well, there's an element called uranium out there. And in recent years, in recent generations, this uranium, we can enrich it. And it can produce and radiate so much energy that we can take some uranium and put it in tubes, and it can generate so much energy that we can heat, we can put electricity in whole cities, in whole regions of the country. That's a pretty amazing thing. And we are just unfolding this. And if we live another 20 years, we will see more of the unfolding, the blossoming of the things that are already in God's creation. The seeds are here. And so it is with people as well. But we'll get to that next. Notice this with this pattern. God observes and judges. This repeated concept that God saw these things that he has made. God sees it and he says, it is good. I just love that. Now what God is doing here is he's delighting in it. God is saying, I made this and oh, I really like it. It just puts a smile on my face. Friday, I had the day off, and I decided to paint some of the trim and some of the doors in the house. And I didn't have a lot to paint, so I bought the nice paint, the expensive, the Benjamin Moore paint. And so I painted these doors, and I don't think anyone else in our household shares my satisfaction in the job that's there. But I just painted, and I looked at it, and I said, boy, I like that. it just looks so much better. Like the scuffs are not there and the crayon and the things. And I was like, oh, it's good. I like that. It's like a freshly mown lawn. I know some of you really like that. It's this satisfaction. God is looking with all of these days of creation. He's saying, boy, that's right. That's just the way I want it. It's good. And I am delighting in it. So God declares it. Now, when he does this, he isn't just saying, you know, this is good, it's better than it was, but he's also showing that he is the judge, okay? In his judgment of all these things that he has made, he says, it was good. And so we see God having this joy and this gladness, which we should see and we should feel when we take the time to slow down and look and observe the things that God has made. You know, people always say, stop and smell the roses. There's something really with that. I'll talk to people that are forced to slow down because their bodies are breaking down. And I remember talking to someone that has gone to be with the Lord, and she would sit on her back porch, and there was a pond behind her house with a little fountain, and she would explain to me how she would watch the squirrels, and she would watch the birds. And that brought so much joy to her. And I got to tell you, that is a good thing to do. It's a good thing to go on a hike. I know that Charlie has talked about, where's Charlie? He's talked about like going on these hikes to Hawk Mountain. And he'll say, don't run ahead of me. And he'll say, look at that. Listen to this. Pay attention to this thing. And what they're doing is they're just going out in God's creation, and they're saying, look at the things that God has made. And we, who are made in his image, can have this concept of the goodness of it. It's like in the Chronicles of Narnia, the Christ character in that, Aslan, the lion, he goes around and he creates Narnia by singing. And it's like this song reverberates through the creation, and that's the point that Lewis was making. We, when we're in this creation, when we listen, when we observe, it's like we can hear the beauty of what God has made. It's like we too can say with God, yes, God, it is good. It is good. And that makes us more alive. God observes and he judges all things. Now here's something else. Your creator is also your judge. The one who has made all things and all of his goodness is also the one that evaluates all of these things and says, good. Notice the ending and the completion of each of these days. At the end of the 6 days, it says, and there was evening and there was morning on that day. The idea here is that there is completeness. There is a cap, an end to each of these 6 days. And then notice this, the beginning and the work through each of these days is this. How did these things come about? God made this so. And here we get a glimpse of his great power. We get a sense of the great authority of the God who made all things. Because when he did make all things, what do we see over and over again? It's this little phrase, and God said. How did God make all things? How did he exercise his power to bring about creation? Well, he did it simply by his word. God is so powerful. God didn't have to have a kit. There was a time before there was light. God said, let there be light. And boom, all of a sudden, light. There was a time before matter. There was a time before all of the things that we can comprehend and measure existed. And God said, let there be. And there was. This is a great God. He is the uncreated creator. And he is good. He is so powerful. And then we see this. We move from God to man. And we're still looking at God, but here he focuses at the second half of the sixth day on man. And what we see is the goodness to us who are his image bearers. A couple months ago, Gordon preached from Psalm 8. And the question there is, what is man? You know, we think about men and women. We're made in his image. But God has his focus on us in a unique and special way. And we look at that and we just say, why? What's going on here that you would have such regard for us? That you would honor us in such a way over all of his creation? Because look, we're made on the same days that he made panda bears and cows. But He made us different. He made us in a way that is close to Him. We are elevated above all creation, made in His image. When God completes the sixth day, notice something different. It was good, is His delight in all that He has made. But look down at verse 31. After God makes man and woman in His image, He says, "Behold, it was very good." And God is saying, "Oh, this is the crown on top. Of all that I have made, now I've made people that are in my image to fill this earth. And I want to display my goodness in all things. And these are the pinnacle of all that I have made." And look at this. He knows us. He honors us. When God sees what He has made, He is delighted in perfection. And He says, He has made us male and female. He has made us to imitate Him and to enjoy Him. The one catechism says, why did God make man? What is the chief end? And the answer is to glorify God by being who we are in line with how He made us, and to enjoy Him forever. Because in living, as He has made each one of us to live, we know and we enter into this same joy that He has in all of His creation. Look at how He gives special honor by making us in His image. It says this, God spoke in the plural, "Let us make man in our image," verse 26. And He says, "I have a plan. I want them to reflect me." Now, what does it mean to be made in the image of God? Well, the concept of image is when you take a stamp or you take a likeness and you stamp it on something. So you can make a coin and you can put someone's face on that coin. Okay, so you have a coin. Or a statue. For some reason, all week has been down at the art museum, the Rocky statue. The thing with images is this. They are like the thing they represent, but you can't reverse that. You can't go up to the Rocky statue. I should pick a real person. You can't go up to the William Penn statue and say, "William Penn is like this," in an accurate way. But you could say, "This is like William Penn," but it doesn't completely represent him because it's just an image that is representing the real thing. We, when God decided He was going to make known who He is in all of His creation, said, "I'm going to make male and female so that they can imitate me in this creation by exercising dominion, by enjoying all that I have made, by ruling it, by filling it." And so God gave special honor to humanity. Look at verse 28. Here's something that I find astounding. God, now, when we speak, our words are powerful. You can remember things that people have said to you from decades ago. Our words are powerful. God's word is almighty. When God makes all things, He says, "Let there be," and by His powerful word, they come into being. But when He makes man, He says, "Let us make man in our image." And then look at what God does. God speaks to us. Now that elevates us above all the things that God has created. Look at what God says. "And God blessed them, and God said to them," directly to Adam and Eve, man and woman, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I've given you every plant yielding the seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree that has its fruit, you shall have them for food, and every beast of the earth." And so He goes on. Look at what God does. God speaks His very word to us, to humanity, made in His image. And this is the way it ought to be. We are made to have a unique relationship with God. We're made in His image. We are created after His very likeness. And so some other things about that. We are people that can think. We are people that have to discern. We are moral beings. And all of these are attributes from God that He has communicated in a way that the real person can be represented by a statue or a stamp. God has all wisdom. But we are able to have wisdom in a degree. God is a God of all wisdom, and we are people that can think. You know, God is moral. He is perfectly righteous and good. And so we are moral agents. And in many ways, God has communicated His very image to put it on us. And that's such an amazing thing. Next it says, God blesses them, verse 28. He blesses us with work to do. He blesses us with something to do in this world. And we'll get back to this more, but what God does is He says, I have a world, I want you to be in charge of it, and I want you to do some work here so that you can reflect me. The way I have done work here in 6 days, you will do work, and you will represent me, and you will have dominion over all of this. So God gives this dominion. And then verse 31, of course, He says, it is very good. God sees for us that this world is fit for His image bearers. He made it for us and for a relationship with Him. And we should comprehend and agree with the goodness of God and creation. We ought to be aligned with God as our Creator, and we ought to be giving Him thanks and delighting in all that He has made. That's how you were made. You were made to know joy in your Creator among His creation. Well, let's move on to the Sabbath then. We get to this seventh day, and we get to the first three verses of chapter 2, and we see this. This day is different than the first six. This is a gift of eternal rest, this holy day, this Sabbath day. This is something that God did, and there's a unique thing about this. Where we saw with the other 6 days, there was evening and there was morning on those days. They had a beginning and an end. The seventh day doesn't have this. The seventh day, if we can put it this way, is an eternal day. The seventh day is God worked, and then He entered His rest. And there's not a temporal cap on this. It is an eternal day. The Sabbath, then, is picked up throughout the rest of the Scriptures as something that is good. The Sabbath is a gift that God has made for His people, made in His image. Jesus said that man wasn't made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath was made for man. In other words, we're not supposed to break our backs serving the Sabbath. The Sabbath is a gift that is given to us from God. So what God did here is a pattern that gets picked up in Exodus and the fourth commandment specifically, where God points back to this eternal day and how God Himself did this, and therefore we who are in this world ought to reflect this. So on Sunday, we set aside this Lord's Day to stop. That's what Sabbath means. It means to cease. And from what do we cease? We cease from our worldly affairs. We put the brakes on our labors, on our toil. And we focus specifically this day on that rest and on the worship that we gather to do. In God's powerful word, we gather to hear it. This is what we're doing right now. We are gathering so that God's powerful word and we who desire a relationship to be rightly connected to Him, we're doing this on this first day of the week, this one day of the seven that is set apart. Now, Jesus said something about rest. He said in Matthew 10, he said, all of you who are weary and heavy laden. Now, there are many people in this world who never look up at the creation God has made. Their faces are on their phones. Their heads are down. They don't look up. They don't behold the beauty of what God has made, and they don't enjoy it. And Jesus says, you do that, you will be weary and you will be heavily burdened. And He says, Jesus says, I want you to find rest. And how? He says, I want you to come to Me. Jesus called Himself the Lord of the Sabbath. And so when we get to this, we have God, we have man, and now we have Sabbath. Here's a question for you. Knowing that we should enjoy this same thing that God enjoyed, that Jesus came to give us rest. When we think about Sabbath rest, do you enjoy it? Do you have a taste for it? Do you have a sense of the goodness of the blessings of God to cease from the things of this world and to, as long as you're still in this world, of course you have to, part of the fourth commandment is you work for 6 days. But there's a day that's the seventh, and then for a believer, for a person that's rightly connected to God, there is a Sabbath rest that we begin to taste in this world. So that it's like you have one foot in this world, and you take one foot and you plant it in eternity with God. And so for people in this world, there is a Sabbath rest that begins now. There yet remains a rest that will be for forever. Kind of like our work in this world is happening now, just like the six-day pattern and then a day of rest. There will be a day when the labor and the toil by the sweat of our brow in this world will be done, and we'll enter into a greater rest that will be eternal. Let me read this from Hebrews 4. This rest is for all who turn to Jesus. In Hebrews 4, it says this, "For we who have believed enter into that rest right now." And then he talks about this. He talks about, look, there is a rest that is still greater to come. "For if Joshua had given them rest," this is Israel, and Israel's story is critically important for all believers today. "If Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his." What does that mean? One of the works from which we can rest because of the Lord of the Sabbath is the work of making ourselves right with God. We who have sinned, and we'll get to this in the weeks ahead, we'll see it in Genesis chapter 3, we are broken from that relationship to be able to enjoy God as we ought to. But Jesus came. Jesus gave his life as a sacrifice. Jesus broke down by removing our sin, this wall of hostility that separated us from our Creator. He came, our Creator came to be our Redeemer. You should enjoy this rest of God. You should delight in the song of all creation. You should look at it and say, wow, and I'm a part of it, and God, I love it. And what you do is very good. Now, we read this, but in John chapter 1, we looked at this in the beginning. Genesis chapter 1 says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." That's how all matter, that's how all being came about. But there is a Creator who is the uncreated one, and He is spoken of in John chapter 1 that we read earlier. Think about this. Before Genesis 1:1 happens, John 1:1 happens. Before there is a creation, there always has been a Creator, and that is God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And in fact, it says that Jesus is the one who is the Creator of all these things. In the beginning was the Word. That's the word logos, okay? This is John writing for this educated Greek audience, saying the word logos, the highest concept that the Greeks could comprehend is captured in that word logos. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This is Jesus. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him. And without Him was not anything made that has been made. In Him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Do you enjoy the rest that He gives? You see, Jesus came to give us Sabbath rest, to rest from our labors, to make ourselves pleasing to God. And so here's something that I want you to take away. You should see and comprehend the great nature of God.